As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
On Tuesday morning, Australia withdrew their intention to host the 2034 World Cup, leaving Saudi Arabia as the sole bidder for football's showpiece event.
Argentina, champion del mundo, champions of the world's greatest game.
With 11 years to go until the circus comes to town, what does this mean for Saudi Arabia, FIFA, and the wider world of football? I'm Ayoa Kimolere. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. With us for this one, we have The Athletic's Adam Crafton, as well as senior football news reporter Matt Slater as well. So Saudi Arabia have ended up with a 2034 World Cup. What happened? Why did Australia step back, Matt?
They realised there was no point standing against Saudi Arabia. The whole thing has been stage managed for Saudi Arabia to get 2034. So at the beginning of October, we got this big announcement that 2030 was completely sorted. The main bit of the tournament being in Spain, Portugal and Morocco, but with these, you know, three games in South America to mark the centenary of the 1930 World Cup. And everyone was like, you know, whoa, that's a lot of news. Oh, and by the way, here's the process for picking 2034. Now, it is important to remember that 2030 bit because we are supposed to be now rotating through football's confederations, six confederations in football connected to the continents. 2026, the next one is the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So that ticks off CONCACAF. And then we do 2030, which is Europe and Africa. Oh, sorry, also in 2030, you've got South America. So there you go. You've sort of swept off loads of pieces from the table in terms of who could go for 2034. It really is just Asia and Oceania. And Oceania is New Zealand and about 12 islands. So we very quickly got round again to Asia, 2022, of course, Qatar. So that announcement came within hours, maybe less than an hour. Saudi Arabia went, great, fantastic idea. Well done, Gianni Infantino. We're ready. And here's our press release. And you've got till the end of October. You've got till Halloween to get your expressions of interest in. So is anyone else ready? No one else was as ready as Saudi Arabia, who've been sort of pestering FIFA for a World Cup, you know, for at least a year. Probably longer. Australia had been thinking about it and had been thinking about possible partners. Indonesia was one. But very quickly, you realised that anyone realised that Saudi Arabia had this sewn up. So that's why they're backed out. That's why there's only one bid. That's why the world will be watching a World Cup in Saudi Arabia in 2034.
Yeah. Adam, why is it important for Saudi Arabia to have this World Cup? Why do they want it so badly?
Well, I suppose the same reason they want so much of what they're getting at the moment. You know, whether you talk about acquiring Newcastle United or disrupting the golf industry with the LIV Tour and then the merger / hostile takeover / whatever you want to call it with the PGA, Grand Prix that we've seen moving over there with F1, huge boxing fights. All of this is part of, it depends who you ask, right? If you ask Saudi Arabia, they will say it's all about diversifying their economy, that oil and gas isn't going to last forever, that you have to have a sustainable long-term economy. The one thing that they have at the moment is a huge amount of cash because the price of oil has been very kind to them over the past couple of years, particularly since the war with Russia and Ukraine. And it's part of a strategy that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has had. You know, he called it Vision 2030, I think, ideal world for Saudi Arabia. They'd have quite liked the World Cup in 2030. And it's not just about sport. It is about, you know, huge investments in tech and healthcare and different forms of energy and all of this, all of the kind of things that I suppose a modern looking nation in an economic sense would be looking to invest in, they've been looking at. So that's what they've been trying to do. And a World Cup is a prestige moment of that. Eyes of the world on Saudi Arabia, trying to make themselves the trading hub of the Middle East, probably looking at issues that are going on between America and Russia and China and thinking maybe we can become, I don't know, best of the rest as a powerhouse within all of that. That's the idea. And then you obviously have the other view, which is kind of the Amnesty International view, that this is all about spending huge amounts of money on sport to deflect attention from human rights abuses. Personally, I think almost both things can be true at the same, not disqualifying what Amnesty International is saying, but I do think there is clearly a huge economic and social push at the moment in Saudi Arabia to try and change the way that that society has functioned compared to a decade ago. You can argue forever as to the extent to which and the pace of which that's happened and how happy people are with that. But, you know, I don't think it's fair when people say, you know, it's nothing to do with a diversification of economy. I mean, it just is.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking from someone who hasn't grown up from a country that's a, you know, football superpower, you know, the World Cup coming to Nigeria, for instance, bloody hell, would be amazing, right? Like, come on, like, and I don't also want to ignore the fact that there'll be a lot of people in Saudi Arabia going, finally, the greatest game in the world is coming to our shores, Matt. But at the same time, as FIFA, as an organization diversifying the sport, I'm looking at the continent of Africa. And what? Morocco's got one. I mean, it's a partial World Cup. This is the only second African country to host a World Cup. And you've got a nation of billions of people. Why don't you just give it to Nigeria? Why don't you just give it to Morocco singly?
You raise some really good points. So, you know, what are World Cups for? What is FIFA for? And you're absolutely right to make that point about Africa. I'd almost make the exact same points about Asia. So whilst Saudi Arabia is a part of the Asian Football Confederation, it's part of a very specific part of the Asian Football Confederation. But we are going back to the Gulf. You know, China has long been mooted as a potential host. They're not ready for lots of reasons, economically, politically, football in football terms, certainly not ready. You think about nations that absolutely love the sport and are huge, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, India. I think there's going to be a big debate in the rest of our lives about India. India, you know, does it go for an Olympics before it goes for a World Cup? I think those are interesting points. FIFA excuse a lot of their slightly controversial behaviour with the sort of sweeping statement, it's about growing the game, taking the game to new places, and that's fine. It's hard to argue against that, particularly if you're sat in a country like the UK, right? So you sort of, you know, have to sort of at least acknowledge that point. It's that FIFA don't go through, they don't sort of, it doesn't pass muster. It doesn't stand up to, you know, its own lofty ideals at times. We are going back to the Gulf. Qatar and Saudi Arabia are neighbours. How much growing of the game does that particular corner of the world need right now? For FIFA, they would probably, whether they'd say it out loud, Saudi Arabia bring a massive amount of money. And what I think what FIFA would probably say quietly is that money will enable us to do the development work in China, Singapore, Malaysia, Nigeria, Cameroon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? That money, and this is our big cash cow, the Men's World Cup generates 90, 95% of our income. That is the key development bit of this story.
Matt, why does Saudi Arabia bring so much money to FIFA in hosting a World Cup?
For exactly the same reasons that, let's say, Qatar did. So there's lots of different ways you can do this. One, you absolutely guarantee them an enormous TV contract. So going into Qatar, one of those sort of key little bits of news that often gets mixed in, there's so much news going on, is that beIN basically just guaranteed them a whopping great TV contract. Was that commercially sound? Who knows, right? beIN is a big, big player these days. It's certainly delivered in marketing terms. There'll be a similar situation with Saudi. Saudi will absolutely give FIFA all the guarantees it needs in terms of broadcast. Second part I strongly suspect over the next 11 years, we're going to see an awful lot of Saudi state-aligned run companies sponsoring FIFA. So broadcast, sponsorships, Saudi Arabia will basically host as much as it can possibly host over the next 11 years. One of the things that came out in the sort of Saudi self-congratulatory messages after, you know, pretty much the confirmation that they're going to get it, was we had 125 nations saying they back us. Those will be poorer football federations who will all now hope for some nice bilateral agreements with Saudi Arabia, be it sponsoring their football, domestic football competitions, be it hosting them in Saudi Arabia, be it funding, I don't know, like a grassroots or a women's program or a referee education program, you name it. Saudi Arabia will sprinkle money throughout the football world for the next 11 years and beyond.
Do we get a sense of just how much a country does benefit from the World Cup, for instance, or perhaps the Olympics, for instance? You know, I was in Brazil when Brazil got back-to-back Olympics and the World Cup. And, you know, you can look on the streets of Rio, people protesting, saying, once the circus has rolled out of town, we know exactly what's going to happen. People are still going to be on the streets begging. People are still going to be poor. Education is still going to be poor. The football infrastructure won't really change much from what it is at this moment in time. You can go back to some of those grounds in Rio and across Brazil. It's a hinterland. I mean, it's gathering dust.
Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the things that appeals, you know, to FIFA around taking it to places like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and that the public are less likely to ask, you know, these really significant questions in the way that you might get in Brazil or the United States or South Africa, right? You could go back to that World Cup and not even those countries, London, right? London 2012. What's the real legacy been relative to what was promised? You know, so much of that area has just been basically sold off. I don't know. I've always viewed these events as the extra holiday that you stick on the credit card. I think that's the reality of it. I think that there's always these huge promises. It was quite funny, actually, that the Qatar Supreme Committee was called the Committee of Delivery and Legacy. Now, I'm not sure how many people are going to be left on that committee to actually do legacy and what that legacy is really looking at. You remember all the talk around Qatar about the stadium? Was it the 974 stadium, mm-hmm. shipping containers, that's going to end up being transported to help poorer nations out, to facilitate football? It's all gone pretty quiet on where on earth that's going to end up. They've got the Asian Cup there early next year, which it will probably be used for. But beyond that, I'm not sure there's that much of a plan. Sometimes football creates an expectation for itself where it says it can fix the world's problems, which is often steered by itself. So, you know, the idea that you're going to deal with poverty in Brazil by hosting a World Cup is unfortunately for the birds. And with regards to Saudi Arabia, look, I mean, they're going to build a load of stadiums, and then what are they going to do with them afterwards? You can talk about this Saudi league that's growing. And yes, you know, for big games between Al Nasser and Al Hilal, you're going to get big crowds. But we've all seen the size of the crowds that have been watching some of the games lower down that table. And I'm not sure there is this appetite to have a kind of Premier League championship style attendances across the country.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Ayo Akinwalere.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I'm interested in this conversation around what the benefits are for FIFA, because we've spoken about it in The Athletic and a couple of articles that have dropped in terms of FIFA finding it slightly difficult over revenue sharing agreements with the United States and Mexico and Canada World Cup at this moment in time. How does that change then the Saudi Arabia World Cup, for instance?
I mean, the difficulty that they have in the United States is, rather than what I imagine will happen in Saudi, much like Qatar, you basically have a couple of state-backed entities that will be set up, and you've got some, therefore, pretty hefty decision-makers signing things off, making decisions. Things happen quickly, you know, once they're decided. In the States, well, there's a few things going on. The first is that in Qatar, well, certainly initially, Qatar needed FIFA a lot more than maybe FIFA needed Qatar, and that's, you know, they needed the prestige of the World Cup. The USA doesn't see it like that. I know I'm concentrating here on the USA because I don't think Canada and Mexico are going to pose quite the same issues. The USA, yeah, they like the idea of a World Cup, but they're not sitting there, you know, waiting for FIFA to come in and tell them how to run major tournaments and how to host events and how to run their stadiums and how to deal with sponsorship and all of that kind of thing. And that is creating an issue because I think FIFA have become quite used to people feeling as though they should be quite grateful that FIFA have come along and kind of handing over their cities to them. And, you know, I think one of the issues that started to emerge is each city will have its own local organizing committee. So FIFA having to, there isn't kind of like a central hub that FIFA can just deal with for all the stadiums. They're having to negotiate with individual stadium owners and local organizing committees. You know, we've seen that this pretty significant issue is developing in LA, where you've got the SoFi Stadium that is owned by the Arsenal owners, the Kroenke family, and they are really digging in and basically saying, whatever the agreement was at the start, we don't think we're getting enough out of it. And, you know, for what you're asking us to do in terms of potentially changing the width of the pitch, in terms of revenue sharing, whether it comes to food and drink and sponsorship opportunities, because none of the local organized committees can organize sponsors that would clash with FIFA sponsors. So if you want a food and drink sponsor, it can't clash with Coca-Cola. There's complications like that that some of the Americans are just looking at and thinking, yeah, this doesn't work for us, so we're just going to renegotiate it. And you might think, well, it's already sorted, you can't renegotiate it. Some of the American businessmen just don't see it like that. They're just saying, this is ridiculous. We don't like it. We're going to change it. One of the other things I think that appeals with FIFA in a place like Saudi or Qatar is you've got all these state-funded facilities, so it makes it far easier to strike deals to rent training facilities and to use the stadiums. So all of those costs, I think, come down quite significantly when you're in Saudi compared to in the States, where you may have at any given time four or five major domestic sports or preseason tours or whatever coming over wanting to use those facilities at great cost. So those are some of the challenges. The flip side is they'll probably never make more from a World Cup than they would in the States.
I guess if you wanted to sort of simplify it, I think FIFA and all other international sports federations, IOC, you know, having exactly the same set of problems as FIFA, has a problem with democracy and also has a problem with free market capitalism. That is the US problem. Too much democracy and definitely too much free market capitalism, i.e. other people looking at this and going, yeah, we're all going to make some money, right? All of us. Yeah. You and me.
The thing FIFA did, and maybe they have to do this because it's, you know, part of their new transparency thing. The projections they have made for what they're going to make out of the US World Cup, was it billions, right?
Oh, 13. And it again went up. They projected upwards this year.
Yeah, so they projected upwards of 13 billion. So, of course, the US stadium owners are looking at, well, what, you're going to come over here, use our stadium, milk everything there is to go off it. Well, what are we getting out of this? And growing the game is not going to cut it if you're, you know, Stan Kroenke, who owns that stadium. And I do understand that. I think some of these stadiums and local cities also don't see a huge difference between hosting England versus Argentina in a World Cup group stage compared to hosting a Taylor Swift or Harry Styles concert.
100%. And I think this is, again, we'd be having the same conversation about an England or a German or a French World Cup. I think Adam has hit something really important there. If you own a NFL stadium, you are not short of things you can put in there that are absolutely amazing, that will energize the city, that the mayor will love, that will bring tax receipts for everybody, that will employ thousands of people on the night. They'll bring the TV cameras in. The World Cup, fantastic, brilliant. We'd absolutely love to have one of those at our stadium. We'd love to have one of those we could put on the side of the wall forever that we hosted da-da-da-da-da here. But it's not, I don't think there's some, I think FIFA want people to be unbelievably gushing towards them. And so does the IOC. Oh my God, what can we do for you? Can we create a tax-free bubble for you? No problem at all. Do you want to run the place for 3 months before? There you go. They're not getting that kind of love from the US stadium owners. They're just not.
It's not just LA, I think, that's going to be raising these issues. I think, you know, if New York, New Jersey don't get the World Cup final, I think FIFA may start finding that they are a little bit more combative in terms of these agreements because, you know, it's New York. Nothing that happens in a World Cup in New York is going to change what New York is, right? It would be a decent week for the economy, but that's it. And I think the Bay Area as well, San Francisco, will also be looking at it in that way. There's other cities that don't have that kind of leverage, right? Kansas isn't going to be able to hold FIFA's feet to the fire. I'm sorry to all the people in Kansas who are listening, maybe upset by that, but they're not going to have the leverage of how embarrassing it would be for FIFA to lose New Jersey or LA, right? And I think the reality is they're not going to lose them because they'll come to an agreement. It will just be an agreement that FIFA wouldn't have chosen to have in the first place.
What about the human rights conversations? And we touched on it at the top. Obviously, there was so much around it for the Qatar World Cup. What do you think FIFA would have learned leading up to the Saudi Arabia World Cup?
Well, some would say that FIFA have learned nothing. And this is certainly the response from Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, various other sort of experts in that area. And they've all had their say and will continue to have their say for the next 11 years. You know, I just want to remind everybody of that. This is the beginning of what's going to be. If you thought the build-up to Qatar was fractious and was at times painful and bitter, lots of name-calling and accusations of bias and racism and Islamophobia, I'm afraid so you ain't seen nothing yet, you know, to sort of kind of use a US term. You know, Saudi Arabia is a bigger, more problematic, more known entity than Qatar. And I sort of almost think that what we witnessed there is almost a rehearsal for what we're going to get. What has FIFA learned? I honestly don't know.
Surely they've learned that when it comes to it, most people won't care, right? And therefore, if you can pull off getting the tournament and getting it over the line, once the show rolls into town, well, I mean, there's been zero impact.
Well, I was trying to think of positive things that FIFA might have learned.
Genuinely, I think they'll still say, everyone watched the Qatar World Cup, Adam. People would say, they would say that was one of the greatest World Cups ever. Look what happened, the upsets. Saudi Arabia beat Argentina. I mean, all those kind of like permutations, they've got that there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's quite interesting that they didn't do 2030 in the end, the Saudis, that they didn't go for it. I think that was partly because they maybe got to a stage where a vote was risky, as in they might lose it, actually. And, you know, a country like Saudi Arabia doesn't like losing votes. It's a bit embarrassing. But I also think that little bit more distance, more time for kind of Saudi to just continue to ingratiate itself, both diplomatically, economically, back into, I suppose, kind of what, you know, you would consider sort of international standards, I think helps them to a certain extent, rightly or wrongly. I think also, even compared to 2 or 3 years ago, just the world has changed a little bit. The world needs Saudi Arabia now more than it did before Russia invaded Ukraine. There is a reality to that. I think this idea, therefore, that FIFA can turn, and I don't just mean here to a UK and US audience, I mean to the whole world, to the global south, and say, oh yeah, we can't be doing Saudi Arabia because of human rights. Well, I think a lot of people in the global south in particular, and actually increasingly in the West, would turn around and say, okay, well, you did a World Cup in Russia. That, I think, is where FIFA just sort of see a little bit of opportunity, to be honest, that it's going to be very, very difficult to sustain arguments for people in the West that because you don't treat people nicely, you shouldn't be able to host sporting competitions. I don't know what you think about that, Matt, but all that, if you remember when we were in Qatar, the amount of times we were told any criticism was Islamophobic, racist, orientalist, a Western gaze, you're not appreciating the way that people in other parts of the world view the world. I can just see all of that multiplying tenfold in light of so much of what's happening in the world at the moment.
And then we had, you know, as a sort of almost response to that, that, you know, the very specific examples were given, you know, around alcohol at stadiums or those endless shots of people mingling in the souk as though this was this remarkable, unique experience. It was good, right? I've been to many, many events in many different sports. It certainly wasn't unique. It wasn't the first time, and it wasn't the best. It was good, right? It was good. But because the build-up had become so toxic at times, it was massively amplified. So we're going to get a lot of that. In terms of, if I go back to your question now, what has FIFA learned? What could FIFA learn? I'd like to think they have learned something just about messaging and managing expectations and handling the very, very reasonable and important questioning from human rights groups, from people who are concerned. We haven't talked about it yet, but absolutely central for me is the migrant worker issues. Everything that gets built in Saudi Arabia is built in exactly the same way that was built in Qatar, exactly the same way it was built in Dubai. And, you know, I know people will now be screaming, going, oh, and what about how things were built here 150 years ago, or the pyramids? Yes, 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 right? But what do we ever learn? When do we ever get better? So I'd like to think that FIFA has learned something from that experience. The proof will be in the pudding, right? I think the problem for FIFA is so much of their messaging, so many of their answers, they're like gotcha answers to questions about Qatar were engagement works. There's no such thing as a perfect host. Your set of values are not everyone's set of values. Give this country a chance. It's on a journey, blah, 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 blah. In 11 years' time, Adam's right to say that it gives Saudi a bit longer. I'd love to think that the Yemen war will be over and we'll be able to see some really practical, tangible evidence that Saudi Arabia's economy has diversified and its people are a bit healthier. And the Saudi Pro League does look more like a genuine domestic football competition. And, you know, 18 other data points. The problem is we will also have 11 more years of legacy from Qatar. And we'll be able to say to them, how are you treating migrant workers now? Has the situation for LGBT plus people changed at all? How are your female sports people doing? What has it done for Doha?
On top of that, you also had situations at stadiums that were pretty appalling. You know, the complaints that went into FIFA's grievance complaint mechanism around the way that, for example, Iranian women who had been protesting were very much under the impression that kind of Iranian state spotters were being allowed to sort of track them, right, at games. I mean, how scandalous that was being alleged to have happened at a FIFA World Cup was really appalling.
I witnessed that. It was one of the worst, ugliest atmospheres I've seen at a game anywhere. It was the Iran-US game afterwards with Iranian fans fighting each other and distraught afterwards, and Qatari police very much policing one side only.
And you saw the same around, you know, FIFA for years and years and years spent time sort of, actually it was more sort of the Qatari side, to be fair, sort of holding these kind of discreet meetings with LGBT groups and human rights groups saying, oh yeah, when you get there, you can put your rainbow flags up or your rainbow t-shirts. And basically it just changed once you got there. Now, therefore, this whole engagement works. Well, okay. Did it work? You could make some arguments that there was progress on migrant workers' rights over time, but at what cost over the whole span of it? But apart from that, I'm not sure there was significant progress to engagement, really. And the question is more whether is Saudi under MBS actually a more forward-looking nation than what Qatar is under the Emir? I think that's going to maybe be the interesting question.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Ayo Akinwole.
I guess the final thing I want to finish on is the Saudi Pro League. What does this mean for the Saudi Pro League, right? Right? I mean, you're looking at building an infrastructure. Surely that Pro League, more and more stars going to the Pro League.
I was thinking Manchester United might be pleased about this. There might be 10 or 11 players that could go there in January or May.
Yeah, there's a Casemiro potentially with a name on it, but that's another conversation. But yeah, I mean, Matt, the Pro League leading up to the World Cup, they're going to want some more big faces to tell everyone that the World Cup's coming to, you know, to Saudi Arabia.
I think the key thing is that this is a doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on the bet on sport. Saudis bet on sport, and football being the most important sport there. It's by far the most popular in the world too. So if you compare it, let's say, to LIV Golf. So in that first year of LIV Golf, I remember all the questions were about, you know, what are they kind of doing here? I went to one of the tournaments and who's actually paid for a ticket and does it matter? And do they have a TV deal? And, you know, and people assuring me, no, this is all definitely 2 years worth of this. All the contracts are signed for next year as well. And you're sort of thinking, right, okay, .. What about year three? What about year four? You know, how far are Saudi going to go with this very aggressive move for golf? You know, what's their appetite here? And, you know, of course, there was a sort of compromise and a fudge and, you know, they've got a peace deal and we'll see. It's almost been sort of swept to the side a little bit. I don't see any suggestion of that. This is now, you know, a decade-long commitment to football. And we're not going to be like Qatar. We are going to have a robust, strong, competitive domestic league. And those ambitions that Ronaldo talked about back in Qatar, you know, when he moved, about, you know, we're going to be a sort of top 10 league, or maybe a top 5 league. That's the ambition. And summer was exciting in terms of generating news and clicks. We're now sort of in this kind of doldrums period waiting for the next transfer window because the actual competition isn't that interesting to anybody outside of Saudi Arabia. Is that going to be the case in 3 years' time, 5 years' time? I don't know. They're saying to us, give us a chance. You know, all right, we got 25 good players over here now. You wait till we've got 50. You wait till we've got 100. You wait till we actually have two tiers and we actually have 400 decent players and we have genuinely displaced some football talent from Europe to here.
Just want to finish on this and slight devil's advocate. I'm just trying to understand it here. Like, if you genuinely do want to take on the more established football nations, leagues around the world, what do you do to break in other than just chuck money at it to see what lands? I mean, you're not going to dislodge the Premier League because of its might, but you have to do something ridiculous to even get people talking about your league. And what the Premier League doesn't have is a state-backed, you know, funding for eternity. I mean, this is a country that can make new cities. How do you do that?
Well, I think for Saudi Arabia, you're right. That probably is the only rational choice, you know, because of, you know, the Saudi Arabia circumstances. It's bigger than Qatar. It's 30 million plus. It's got a young population. So it's not a tiny place, but equally it's not China. It's not going to close the gap by the size of its internal market. It's not India. It's not China. It's not US sized. But it does have a lot of money, and it has an awful lot of money now. And to go back to the sort of very original answer, very first answer about, you know, what's this all about? The diversification of the economy point is really important. I know it winds people up who say it's only sports washing. Trust me, it's not only sports washing. This diversification of economy stuff is absolutely central to it. And it's not just because it's sort of like clever and it's what sort of you'd expect any state in its situation to do. You know, you've got a lot of one thing and we've got to do more of other stuff, right? There's actually a bit of a sort of ticking time bomb element to this. The fossil fuel stuff isn't going to last forever. Or let's say the world's dependence on fossil fuels isn't going to last forever. Massive debates about how and when. And I think, you know, all the sensible people are suggesting that it's going to be a little bit longer than we hope, maybe. But it's not going to last forever. So you have this incredible one-trick pony economy that must do something. Must. That's the key thing. So there's MBS, the House of Saud, the ruling family know that the future of their country, the future of his family's hold on that region utterly depends on diversifying. He's got to find jobs for this population to do. He's got to find things for them to do, to watch and enjoy. There's a lot of internal crowd control going on here as well. So given the size of its population, the need for speed, the amount of money they have right now, this is the way. You throw money at it. You aggressively do this. So I guess like a comparison would be how the US has built its soccer league. It started with the World Cup. Well, first of all, okay, it started with razzmatazz and trying to sort of add a US flavor to this global game and bring over famous people, you know, Pelé, Beckenbauer, Best. Yeah, yeah. They tried that. It didn't work. So then they kind of reset with the World Cup. Then they went organic. They went cost control. They went softly. Lots of soccer fans in the States, I remember in the noughties and tens, you know, let's get on with it. We're the US. Then we go Beckham. that sort of signaled the next step. And now we go Messi. So America, with its 350 million population, massive, fully developed sports economy, world leading status, all the sort of tech side, everything, that's the way they can go. Saudi Arabia must do that in a fraction of the time. The answer to your question is the way they're doing it, I think, is the only way it will work for them. And let's see how they get on.
All right, let's leave it there. Matt, Adam, thanks so much for your time. Please remember to rate and review the podcast if you're enjoying it. And don't forget, you can sign up to The Athletic today for a special limited time offer of just $1.99 a month for 12 months at theathletic.com/footballpod. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to The Athletic Football Podcast. The producers were Adonis Pratsides and Guy Clark, with additional production by Mike Stavro and Jay Beal. The executive producer was AD Moorhead. To listen to other great Athletic Football podcasts for free, search for The Athletic on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places. The Athletic Football Podcast is an Athletic Media Company production.
The Athletic.